The story of this Merzbauer is very tragic, because we really don't know, or we really can't be sure, if this particular room that had been reconstructed would have been open to the public if the political situation had been different. Nonetheless, Schwitters was absolutely aware of the importance of the Merzbauer as a work of art, and he called it his life work. We can assume that he would have tried to make it public later, if it hadn't been destroyed, and maybe it would be a museum, because his son was always aware of the importance of his father, even after he was forgotten, after the war, and could have made this possible. And so although the room this reconstruction is based on was a private room, and only a few people who were interested in art had seen it, Schwitters did want to be recognised as the artist of the Merzbauer Hanover. He did want to make it public. Later in Norway, Schwitters started a new construction from the point where he stopped in Hanover. During this process, he wrote to other artists saying that starting his construction again wasn't difficult for him at all. Instead, it was an opportunity to improve his project. He learned a lot in Hanover, and he wanted to make his Merzbauer better, and in Norway he was able to do so. The thing is, Schwitters wasn't completely satisfied with the Merzbauer Hanover, because it was bridging a number of stylistic shifts, and this meant there were contradictions within the Merzbauer. There was the Dadaist style, a very literary thing, followed by a symbolist style, followed by the constructivist style, which we see in the reconstruction today. And later, Schwitters just thought that the Merzbauer Hanover was far too much of a mix. He didn't want to show things from 10 years ago, so he closed it.
Hello, I'm Callie Spooner, and I'm here with the artist Jessie Ash in a programme we're calling The Movable Column. The Movable Column explores work by the artist Kurt Schwitters, who for 13 years between 1923 to 1936 worked on an extraordinary construction that came to be known as the Merzbau. The Merzbau in Hanover was a fantastically constructed interior built from found objects, three-dimensional shapes, bus tickets, wrapping paper, newspapers and artworks in what could essentially be described as a 3D collage. This collage spread to eventually 8 rooms in his house in Hanover, then eventually to a hut in Norway and a barn in England. Schwitter's Merzbau was, on principle, an uncompleted work, but the Hanover permutation was destroyed in Allied bombings, then much later reconstructed by the Swiss theatre designer Peter Beiziger and the curator Harold Zeman from 3 black-and-white photos in 1981. Using this reconstruction as a starting point, the Movable Column explores the possibilities of reconstruction, finitude, rehearsal, performance and progress that surround Merzbau's history and present status. And this current series of the Movable Column is part of an exhibition called In the Belly of the Whale, Act 3, which is curated by Rosie Cooper and Ariella Jedger. This particular programme is going to be sort of exploring ideas of rehearsal and aimlessness in relation to performance and the idea of what it means to complete a work of art or to never complete a work of art. And we're just going to be talking through some of these ideas with contributions from the artist Adam Chodsko, Will Holder and Jacopo Milani. And I think we're going to start with just a little clip from an interview that Jessie did with Adam Chodsko this morning.
Position for an
interview.
Okay, well, don't start playing with it. Okay, so I just wanted to, well, partly.
Is that still
single? Yeah. Yeah. Please put that down.
Okay.
All right. So. So recently you started writing that thing.
No, I didn't.
Which was called.
I didn't.
What?
I didn't
know. It was called.
No, I didn't know.
You're going to be hopeless.
No, I didn't.
All right. I'll approach it from a different.
You wrote a book called Tonga Kunga.
Right.
And it was really, really.
No, I was just curious because I think,
bad.
Particularly when it comes to any sort of school holidays, I noticed this huge backlog of kind of unfinished projects. So. There was things like the Stimpy film that we made, and then there was.
Rubbish.
Was it? And what about the film we made in Dorset? That we got halfway through. That was pretty good. And then there's all these, you know, there's your zombie film.
Like it when you're like, cut, and it's like, my finger.
Mm. So, and then there's your zombie film, and Clay, there was your recent, your DVD covers, right. Something you were going to do with Jai. And so there's all this stuff, there's a huge amount of stuff that you start, and then
you never finish.
And it's not, that's not a problem at all, but I'm just curious as to how you feel about that stuff.
Yeah, what's your code?
Dad, I'm going to make a film. That was
you're going to make a film with all your friends?
That was your code,
mate. And do you think you'll finish it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was your code, fam.
That'll be
1390.
Oh, everybody's going to re-hear that now.
So do you need to finish it? Do you have to finish it before the holidays end?
No, I think maybe it's that they're quite ambitious projects, really. These filming things, and we'll start them and start editing them, and then we just run out of time. And then I was thinking, are we going to pick that up again? But they don't seem to really need to at all. It doesn't seem. We move on to the next one. So, and I think, you know, I think I have a bit of anxiety about not completing stuff or having stuff half finished, and or seeing something as a kind of process that's purely for an experiment to enjoy exploring. But you have to kind of explore it in these ways. You have to explore it as though there is going to be definitely a finished. There'll be a finished film. There'll be a finished book.
Yeah,
and Seth, just you know, despite his denial, just started writing this amazing story, which seems to be a little bit based on something like Philip Pullman's Dark Materials. And you were really, really into it.
It's about racism.
It was about racism, yeah.
Yeah.
What happened? Is there like a story or?
Yeah. But like, so like, all the people with wings are, no, but like they're bugs, like insects, and all the people with wings are white people, and all the people who don't have wings are black, and then they don't have the advantage of flying, so the people who do have wings think they're like, oh, there's something wrong with them and stuff, so they accuse them.
And there's rioting, and
yeah,
there's a father who's actually based a lot on the father in Billy Elliot, isn't he?
Yeah.
And the mother comes from?
The mother, I don't know, but she died as well.
Mm. But she was based on someone from a fiction that you knew pretty well.
It was from, what's that film about, My Life as a Dog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So a mother who's ill, who's bringing up these boys. And so you're working on it, this was very recently, pretty compulsively every night, and then just it kind of stops. So I'm wondering at what point, what makes you stop?
I don't know.
Did you get bored?
I just don't know what else to write now. But I didn't do that much. I did about 8 pages.
Mm.
But I typed it out. Have you got it on here?
Yeah.
Have you got it on here?
Oh no, I haven't got it on there, no.
Oh.
No. Mm. All right.
So that was a little bit from this morning. I went up to North London and was talking with Adam and his kids. We were on a roof, so sound quality may reflect that. Perhaps.
I could hear it.
Okay, good. Well, as long as someone can out there. So yeah, we went up a ladder and we started talking a bit in relation to Adam's interest in Merzbau. And Adam was desperately trying to involve his sons, who were partially trying to opt out and opt in of the discussion, which was sort of appropriate in a way. But yeah, as you can hear, there's this sort of idea of, first of all, holidays, Easter holidays, and he's, you know, working with his kids, and they're doing loads of stuff, which is great. But what was, I thought, quite interesting about that little bit was the fact that the kids had no real interest in actually thinking about what it necessarily is, i.e. to package
finish something, to
think back, like we are doing now, for example.
Yeah.
We're both trying to package that thing on top of the attic. But the boys, Seth and Clay, were more interested in trying to break the code for Adam's iPhone, which is sort of another
new project.
Exactly. And I don't know, it sort of seemed really fitting in a way.
But I think this, I'm terrible for sort of starting things and not finishing them. And I've always thought that this is sort of maybe my justification, perhaps, for not finishing this, and that there's potentially some kind of good to be had from perpetual kind of beginnings or perpetual starts. And I've never been particularly interested in the idea of, you know, finishing something or making an object or kind of completing it. But it has to be said that a whole lot of full starts doesn't really kind of make for particularly good progress. But then if you're not necessarily interested in progress, which they're not, because they're just interested in play, because they're on their Easter holidays and they want to be sort of spending time with each other and just starting lots of new things, then perhaps there isn't a sense of needing to kind of complete something or finalise something within that. And I'm just wondering how this sort of relates to Schwitters and this idea that perhaps what he was working on within the Merzbau was a form of play in some way, and how this is, I don't know, I guess the difference between sort of having to kind of perform or to play in some ways, and this idea of creating an object or finishing something or kind of finally completing a project in some way might be a form of kind of performance or an achievement in some way that doesn't necessarily sit so well with this idea of beginning something new all the time with someone that you want to hang out with.
And with Schwitters, we know that he definitely needed the idea of something finished at the end, which is something we're going to go on to talk about in a bit.
But then this kind of undoes the idea that what he was doing in the Merzbau was play. Is that what you mean? Because it seems
The boys on the roof, as soon as the microphone came out, for me that was the finished project, and they weren't interested. Because, I don't know, it became something that had perhaps an authority or some sort of thing which wasn't what they do, or what kids do, which is just make. And I asked Adam a little bit about, we were talking about Minecraft, which is like a game, virtual reality game of construction. And I was asking, where's the audience for this play, you know? And he was just talking a minute ago about anxiety of construction or making or production that I think a lot of artists share. But it didn't seem evident with those guys. And I wondered if it was because they don't need to show it. You know, it doesn't need to be public or it doesn't need to be shared. But then that was sort of contradicted by the fact that a lot of the online games like Minecraft are then shared, put on YouTube and publicly made visible.
Yeah, but this is about play in terms of the build-up towards a kind of a final act of kind of creation, no? Or the actual, the sort of the process of leading to something that's finally going to, you know, contribute to putting something new into the world, and that being a kind of an end in some way. And I think one of the things that Adam was saying to them was this idea of, like, you've got all of these kind of potentially finished, you know, episodes of creation that haven't quite sort of finished themselves off, and they've lost interest in them after the kind of the initiation, or this idea of being like, I'm going to make a book that's a bit like this, that da, da, da. And then they kind of give up halfway through, and they're not so much interested in the kind of the final thing. And I suppose the thing that we're interested in thinking about in terms of Merzbau is whether or not Schwitters, I don't know, I think it is this idea of whether or not he was playing or whether or not he was trying to kind of create something specific. And there's certain amounts of evidence that indicate that maybe the Merzbau was actually a sculpture rather than just a big kind of biological activity where he was just kind of playing around with a load of things and collecting a lot of stuff in his, you know, in his room. It was actually maybe just quite a complicated work of art.
Well, talking of complicated, works of art. No, not talking of complicated works of art, but talking about maybe even language as an object or a collection of sporadic material that brought together to make some sort of
assemblage.
Yeah. that brings us to Will Holder.
Yeah. So Will Holder has made us an amazing contribution for this next series of shows. And he's it's a recording that he's made here at Resonance, and he's asked us to introduce it. And I thought that actually perhaps the best way to do it was let him introduce it. And I'm just going to read out an email that he sent us. Dears, what I had in mind was recording the Klaes Stadtmuller Kirchwitter's lectures and cutting it into three parts. It's basically Stadtmuller's collage / Murr's composition of fragments of poetry, writing and press from Schwitter's life, centering around the poem with the lines, I build my time in gathering flowers and throwing out the weeds. I build my time in gathering fruits and throwing out all that is bad and old and rotten, whose lines build up and return throughout. It has some beautiful sound poems in it, which are a test to my reading skills and a pleasure to rehearse. The text should really be read in its entirety and broken over three broadcasts. It's probably a good thing, but I don't think 3 times 5 minutes would cover it. More like 3 times 10. Would be great to get a recording studio, get the whole thing and cut it into thirds. These are the days I'm around. March 5th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 19th, 20th, 21st. You will. And so here's the recording.
I build my time. Columns, grottos, niches. A collage built on texts by Kurt Schwitters. Klaes Stadtmuller, Coracle, 2001. Part 1. First, I combined individual categories of art. I pasted words and sentences in poems in such a way as to produce a rhythmic design. Reversing the process, I pasted up pictures and drawings so that sentences could be read in them. I drove nails into pictures in such a way as to produce a plastic relief aside from the pictorial quality of the painting. I did this in order to efface the boundaries between the arts. The materials are not to be used logically in their objective relationships, but only within the logic of the work of art. The more intensely the work of art destroys rational, objective logic, the greater become the possibilities of artistic building. As in poetry, word is played against word. Here, factor is played against factor, material against material. Das Malen der Gegensätzlichkeiten in der Natur ist abstrakt. Baue ich aber ein an meinem Atelier, so schaffe ich Hüllräume und Flächen für das Licht und vermehre sie durch Farben. Scheint das Licht draußen durch Weidensträucher, so beobachte ich, was ich im Atelier in den Grotten baue. Nicht die Gegenstände sind mir wesentlich, sondern die Musik, die das Licht auf ihnen spielt. As long as I paint, I also model. Now I'm doing Mertz plastics, pleasure gallows and cult pump. Like Mertz pictures, the Mertz plastics are composed of various materials. They are conceived as round plastics and present any desired number of aspects. Just in the middle of her knee, there I observed the fact that she possessed a little reddish mole. It was alone, just one and sole, and even if there had, maybe, been two, which were just on her knee, just in the middle would be one. In fact, it does, a fact I would ask you to discuss. Let points burst like stars among them, dance a whirling round and realize each other to form a line. Bending the lines, crack and smash angles, choking, revolving around the point. From 1930 onward, Kurt Schwitters welcomes everybody to come and have a look at his Märzbau in Hanover. Ich habe große Bilder beklebt und besonders Plastiken geschlemmt und an meinem drei Säulen gearbeitet. What is this column? It's first of all only one of many, of 10 perhaps. It's called Cathedral of Erotic Misery, or abbreviated COEM, for we live in this age of abbreviations. In addition, it is incomplete on principle. You might say it grows according to the principle of the city. Somewhere another house is to be built, and the Municipal Housing Commission has to see that the new house does not make a mess of the whole urban picture. In the same way I come across some object, I know it belongs to the COEM. I take it along, paste it on, glue something onto it, daub it, in the rhythm of the total effect, and one day we find that some new trend has to be shaped, which passes wholly or partially over the dead body of the object. In this way, there remain everywhere things which wholly or partially cut across each other, as a distinct indication that they have been devaluated in regard to their individual unity. Through the growth of the ribs, there originate valleys, hollows, grottos that maintain their individual existence within the whole. Through the fact that intercrossing lines of direction are connected with each other through planes, there develop twisted screw-like forms. The whole are systems of cubes of the most severe geometric character until it seems fused into a unity. The name COEM is only a label. It does not express the contents or, at any rate, only a part. Die Märzsäule wurde zum Märzbau einer ganzen Räum rundum gestaltet. I build my time. Hanover, den 28.02.1935. Liebe Suse, I'm sitting here in the library. It is, however, only a room of 1 square meter in one of the corners of my studio. I like to sit there because it's situated on high and so calm, and the walls surrounding it are pasted and full of nails. I'm still working on that room, and I want to write there later on. Some sort of twisted stairs lead up there, and they're very narrow. When I'm up there, my feet dangle, which, I'm sure, is very healthy. With every thorough cleaning of my rooms in spring, new things come about. Just today I finished 2 grottos. One of them has longing for a theme, and the other has circus. In front, the one shows Mr. Remmer, who, as one can tell from the looks, definitely is not longing at all. And at the back there is a slushy poor girl with flowers. Furthermore, oriental landscape, a Buddha, a girl in the circus, and the words, lightly come, lightly go. The circus grotto is very shoddy as a whole, especially a glittering blue vase of glass from the Christmas tree is decisive for its character. I have myself glazed the 2 grottos today, an effort that I'm proud of, and slowly, very slowly, there's a progress in materializing the entire studio. But then you will have to look at it yourself. In May, I hope. Anna Blossom has wheels. O thou, beloved of my 27 senses, I love thine. Thou, thee, thine, I thine, thou mine, we? That belongs, by the side, not here. Who art thou, uncounted woman? Thou art thou? People say thou wearest. Let them say they don't know how the church tower stands. You wearest your head on your feet and wanderest on your hands. On thy hands wanderest thou. Hallo, thy red dress clashed in white folds. Red, I love Anna Blossom. Red, I love thine. Thou, thee, thine, I thine, thou mine, we? That belongs by the side in the cold glow. Red Blossom, red Anna Blossom. How say the people? Price question. 1. Anna Blossom has wheels. 2. Anna Blossom is red. 3. What color are the wheels? Blue is the color of thy yellow hair, Red is the whirl of thy green wheels, thou simple maiden in everyday dress, thou dear green animal, I love thine. The big M is finished. It's the negative function of the COEM, the Cathedral of Erotic Misery. It's the monument of pure art. It's the purposeless shape of things that once in former times used to have a purpose. Thus, it is Mertz. It is the result of 7 years' restless and consistent work. Only some details in a few places are left, and that's why I need material, and therefore I apply to you. Renowned artists have already cooperated in important parts. In these big grottos, however, there is now a lack of internationally significant material, such as tramway and cloakroom tickets, visiting cards, voting papers, playbills, show cards, and especially photographs. By now, many important persons are represented in my big M. For instance, Harman, Hitler, Hindenburg, all Roman gods, Captain Dreyer of the sunken Monte Cervantes, Konrad Veidt, Mussolini, my wife and I, our son, Professor Wanken and his son Pünzelchen, Mrs. Elizabeth Klenner, and many, many others. Please do endow items from your sphere which you have become attached to, be it art, trash, or whatever you want. Perhaps strange. The world is full of goods trains. The passengers are cows and milk and butter and cheese and lovely marmalade and bulls and horses and cocks and hens. The cow is mother to the milk and grandma both to cheese and butter. The cheese is cousin to the marmalade. The horse is cousin to the cock. The hen lays eggs. The egg is cousin to the cheese and butter, the son and daughter of the milk. Isn't it strange? It is. A wide outside stair leads to the big love grotto, underneath which stands the female lavatory attendant of life in a long, narrow corridor with scattered camel hair. Two children greet us and step into life. Owing to damage, only a part of a mother and child remains. Shiny and broken objects set the mood. In the middle, a couple is embracing. He has no head, she no arms. Between his legs, he's holding a huge blank cartridge. The big twisted around child's head with the syphilitic eyes is warning the embracing couple to be careful. This is disturbing. But there is reassurance in the little bottle of my own urine in which immortelle are suspended. The patient constipated adores his constipations. He feels himself related to the United Nations. All the grottos are characterized by some major features. There's the Nibelungen hoard with its gleaming treasure, the Kiffhäuser with the stone table, the Goethe grotto with one of Goethe's legs as a holy relic and his many pencils poetry worn to stub ends, the sadistic murder cavern with the sorely mutilated body of a pitiful young girl tainted with tomatoes and many Christmas gifts, the Ruhr region with genuine anthracite and genuine coke, the art exhibition with paintings and sculptures by Michelangelo and myself, the only visitor to which is a dog with a bride's train, the dog kennel with WC and with the red dog, the organ which has to be turned to the left for it to play Silent Night, Holy Night, the 10% crippled war veteran who has no head but still manages to get along somehow or other with his daughter, Mona Hausmann, consisting of a picture of the Mona Lisa with her face pasted over by Raoul Hausmann, through which it has lost completely its stereotyped smile, the bordello with the three-legged lady, done by Hannah Hoch. I am the buck. I chisel luck. I griffel thaler. I am the maler. You are foidin. You chisel tin. You a griffel turkey. You are the perky. I have only given a small part here of the literary content of the column. Some grottos like the Luther Corner have already disappeared beneath the present surface. The literary content is dadaistic, but that's not to be wondered at since it dates from the year 1923, and in those days I was a dadaist. But now the column, having taken 7 years for its construction, the form has evolved ever more severely in proportion to my intellectual development, especially in the ribs. The total impression, then, reminds us perhaps of Cubist paintings or of Gothic architecture, you might think. Imagination. Four navvies sat on a roof. The first one said, "Oof." The second, "How is it possible then," the third, "that the roof can support us when," the fourth, "roofs without girders never can." And then it rang. The roof went bang. You see? But then, towards the end of 1936, a few weeks only before Schwitters leaves for Norway in fear of having the Märzbau destroyed by the Nazis, he writes to friends in Switzerland. "Inzwischen ist es zu Häusern noch schwerer geworden. Es ist bald möglich, dass man auch in Italien nicht mehr will bearbeiten dürfen, was man will. Es kann sogar das sein, dass man mehr das Atelier zerstört."
Every now and then, I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice and easy. But there's just one thing, you see. We never, ever do nothing nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough. But we're gonna take the beginning of this song and do it easy. But then we're gonna do the finish rough. It's the way we do Proud Mary. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river. Listen to the story now. Left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. And I never lost 1 minute of sleep, and I was worrying about the way that things might have been. Big wind.
Rolling on a river.
Yeah, so that was Proud Mary, sung by Tina Turner and Ike. And we went straight into that song after Will's reading, specifically because the author of the score that Will was reading...
Clay Stadmuller.
Ah, yes. Could specifically split sections up into three different parts. And this is how we're splitting Will's contribution up over the next three programs. So in the split between each section, the author...
Clay
Stadmuller. The author specified that music, in brackets, music possible. So over the next three shows, we'll be following that that notation or that instruction.
With a cover song.
Ah, yeah, with the changing,
that's
the, a changing
that's
cover
the,
song.
That's the important link. This is our our kind of our popular culture diversion into the possibility of reconstructions and redos via the Mers Bow. And this is a redo of Proud Mary, which was originally... Who's it originally by? We've got a Wikipedia article here.
Originally written by John Fogerty.
Yes.
And selected by... Well, or given to us, suggested to us by... Jacopo Milani, who is an artist who's contributing to the exhibition in Spain that we talked about at the beginning. And he sent this over, and he particularly chose it. This is a sort of a message from him, but he was particularly interested in the change of pace and this movement from completely soft, almost like a ballad, into something which, in his words, smells of gasoline. he was talking about, this was briefly, but he was talking about control and losing that control, and the song had had many different interpretations and confusions. And as he says in his words, these confusions go with the rolling and rolling movement, moving like a whisper. Yeah, moving from something very soft to very rough.
Yes, it's a nice transition. I wanted to talk a little bit about Will's reading and this notion that kind of arose sort of halfway through in it, which was, I'm guessing, one of, because that Will's reading was a combination of Kurt Schwitter's poetry and various kind of... it's a combination of his writings and his poetry and other bits of found material. I mean, it's a real kind of mix of things, which is in keeping with sort of the Mers principle, whereby sort of everything, all things belong to all other things. And also Kurt Schwitter's kind of background as a master of collage, really. So it makes sense for this particular lecture to have been kind of formed in keeping with the way that Schwitter's makes his work. But there was this one kind of set of words, I suppose, that sort of arose in the middle of it, and I couldn't say whether it was sort of from a Kurt Schwitter's poem or a piece of Clay Stadmuller's own writing, but it was talking about this notion of restless work, and I wanted to talk about this idea of restless work in relation to this perpetual kind of restarting or redoing of something, and whether restless work can be in keeping with the idea of finishing anything in general. We've talked about the idea of Mers Bow potentially, because Schwitter's eventually photographed it, and there were only three photographs left of the Mers Bow. It was rebuilt from these three pictures, and we sort of talked about in some of the previous episodes the idea that by even photographing this evolving, mutable kind of construction, this 3D collage, implicit within that gesture was the idea that perhaps he felt that he had an object, or that he felt that a certain part of the Mers Bow sort of might have been finished. And I'm just sort of wondering how this is in keeping with the notion of restless work, which seems to be the driving force that did run alongside the Mers Bow. And I'm really interested in this notion of restless work, and it sounds like Adam Chodsko's children were doing some particularly restless work in terms of picking up lots of things and then not starting them, and sort of interested in Adam's attempt to sort of say, yeah, but you have all this stuff, and you know, it's not it's not done, you know.
This restlessness, though, is also a chase. And the movement of it is really important. After the song Proud Mary as well, where you're in the mechanics of a boat, which is moving down a river, which has its own tidal or has its own currents. And this idea also that the people on the boat within the words in the track are escaping an oppressed position of cleaning plates, that the boat has a potential vista of liberation. So there's this sort of movement. When you're talking about restlessness, there's also, in some of the things we're just working through here, there's a movement towards something. And in Will's, some of the things where Will was reading, when you're talking about restlessness in production, there's also restlessness in a desire to just move. And that might be a move almost instinctively away from oppression in one case, but also through the body. Because a lot of the references, which I hadn't really thought about previously, that Will was narrating, really, you know, Schwitters is referring to ribs all the time. He's referring to grottos as parts of organs. The whole thing is really sort of physical. And both cases, we're hearing Will's breath as well, and the pauses, and the glitches in his mouth, trying to make this sort of very
corporate, trying to make this text move.
Yeah, I think there's a restlessness that's not just about production, but it's also very much about a sort of almost like an instinctive bodily desire to get somewhere.
It's interesting though, because it's not, and I think this relates to this notion of sort of aimlessness that was suggesting this episode might sort of explore potentially in relation to rehearsal, or perhaps the opposite of rehearsal, in the sense that you can't rehearse aimlessness, you just sort of move, or you just kind of go and see what sort of occurs. And I just think I don't know, it seems that the important thing that arose from Will's reading, and the important thing about the Merzbau, is that there wasn't, didn't really seem like he knew where he wanted to go. There was no particular destination. There wasn't that sense that there was anywhere in particular that one would like to end up. It was sort of movement for the sake of movement in some ways. And I don't know whether or not, if one lacks a destination, one is always aimless, but restless work, maybe restless work does have destinations.
Well, we were just talking about this in relation to what on earth we're doing, because one of the things, I mean, do we have a destination? I mean, that sounds really cheesy, actually.
Destination.
As soon as you say that, it's cringing. But what we're saying is, okay, so we like this idea of this thing that's ever evolving, and it's not, you can't put a, you know, finger on it. But what we've also done is made a website.
Yeah.
Which has exactly done that. We have presented or created a finishing point or something which becomes an archive of in a sense. And I don't know, I think Schwitters did have a goal. I mean, I'm starting to really, really think that. And
so you think the Merzbau was a goal orientated kind of practice?
Well, as I mean,
practice.
Adam Chodzko goes on in a little bit.
Should we let Adam Chodzko go on a little bit, and then we can talk about it?
Yeah, why don't we do that?
Okay, go for it.
Okay, so so can we talk? What do you want to do? Why don't you go and finish off watching the film? Or is that something else that's going to be an unfinished project?
Whoa, whoa, whoa!
Okay.
Have we got it on the map?
What's that? No, I haven't.
I'm stuck.
But I think the thing to do with this fear of destruction, when again, I mean, it's very, you know, he embarks upon this new Merz, but in a place that's the site of a gunpowder works. So it's called Cylinders. And I think it was used, I mean, that area has a particular kind of wood, which is very good for making carbon for gunpowder. So, you know, he chooses a site which is full of this kind of implication of explosions. And then also is, you know, it's just so incredibly wet. So there's moss just choking everything. And it reminds me of that point where Werner Herzog is talking in Burden of Dreams about that. There's this point where suddenly, after trying to do this kind of epic event with the boats, and everyone else is you know, full of doubts and is leaving, and there's all these, you know, there's so much trouble, and the whole way through is just completely myopically pursuing this dream without hesitating at all, almost sort of without looking at the problems that somehow it will keep him, sustain this energy just to sort of plow on regardless. And then there's a point where he just sort of he seems to give up, and he runs out of energy, and he suddenly notices the jungle around him, and he talks about this, he talks about it with such sort of disgust, but as this sort of fertile, just constantly growing but constantly choking itself as well, that it's there's something depraved about it, something obscene about this nature that's around him. And there's something, you know, there's something strange about the landscape around that bit of the Lake District, just this, you know, all the trees really are covered in this moss that kind of drags them down and pulls them down, and then there'll be snowfall that sort of pulls them down. So it's very messy. And I think, you know, there was water running right through, the barn is set into the hillside a little bit, but there was no dam causing, so water, you know, when it rains, it just sort of ran through the barn. And I think Fred Brooks in 1969, he writes this article about the moving of the of the wall to the Hatton Gallery, just the whole process of, you know, how they dug it out. And it's, you know, he can see water running over this thing that Schwitters have been building. So he's building against this. It's like sort of building something in the middle of a stream. They must be constantly shifting, moulding, coming away from itself, and you know, whilst that allows the creation of detritus on a much wider scale, allows him to kind of pick up stuff from streams and all the rest to bring into this thing. It's also, I think it's like building a sandcastle with a tide coming in. It's Well, I think, you know, I think he had self-consciousness about that, and I think there's also, I'm fascinated with how people were perceiving, you know, becoming aware of this project that he was embarking upon, how people in other parts of the world were kind of behind him and sort of excited about this, and there was a kind of conversation going on amongst them about, oh, he's out there, and they, you know, and again, a kind of mythologizing of, you know, people who'd never been to the Lake District for, perhaps, who would just kind of imagine this barn, and they set it into a landscape which is totally different from the landscape it's really in, but they, you know, they're excited about the project. And then the person that I became very intrigued by was this guy Kaufman, who funds through MoMA this, you know, this money that enables Schwitters to work on the barn, but the, you know, previously intended for it to rebuild the Hanover, if there was enough of it left. And he, Kaufman is this department store owner in Pittsburgh who also commissioned Frank Lloyd Wright to make Falling Water. So there was this odd fascination with these things, these very kind of ambitious projects happening out in the woods somewhere. So he's in the centre of Pittsburgh, owns the department store that was called Kaufman's and then later becomes Macy's. And in this office on the 12th floor, he which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, he's sort of, you know, I like to imagine him then thinking about Schwitters remotely doing these things. And this idea of sort of remote interference or remote influence and remote patronage from people who feel it's very important to kind of enable these things happening well away from them, things that they may not actually see, but they like this idea of, you know, Schwitters as a kind of hermit and Schwitters as this explorer out in the wilderness
and doing that,
this thing.
That remote remote patronage, but also what you could say is like a mixing ingredients from a distance, or there's a sort of remoteness to production. Or, and I was just thinking about that in relation to what I know a little bit of some of your works and advertisements being placed in different cities where they're not meant to be, or secondhand clothes being taken to another geographic location, allowing tidal change or environmental patterns to compose pieces of work and I just wonder, maybe is that sort of where your interest in Switters is? I mean, because you're independently interested at the moment, aren't you?
I think it's one of the strands. I mean, I think I am always, well, I mean, I think going back to the role of the artist and where you're, frequently you're working, I mean, however much your work sort of stems from a network of other kinds of like creative practice, or to collaborate with anthropologists or architects or whatever, there's still a sense in which we're kind of, you know, working on these things in a very insular, introspective way. And I think there's something about needing to step outside that sometimes with really a kind of empathy or perception through someone else's eyes. Because I think, you know, I think one of the problems with this sort of community of insular, introspective people, which kind of makes up the art world, is that it's partly a very terrifying process. And I think the way we react to that is to try and make things as comfortable for ourselves as possible, which is why, you know, this language develops, which alienates all these, you know, people from outside it. So, you know, art seems to have this language which describes itself, which is very different from how people would critique theatre or film or dance. And so, you know, perfectly intelligent people who are part of, involved in choreography, say, but just find reading a press release just completely alienating. And I think, I think that's part of a process of forming kind of comfort and purifying a language which makes us feel as though we're part of something together. And I think therefore there's a necessity to keep on projecting outside that, because actually it becomes very limiting what is perceived as being possible from art if you just sort of stay within that space.
Yep, so that was Adam. We talked loads, and it's a shame we can't have everything.
But, yeah.
One of the things that came out from the discussion, definitely for me, was this idea of how the project has is provoked massive institutional social exchanges.
Schwitters, Mers Bowers, like, so the ones that are in the lake, the Mers Barn, which is in the Lake District, is that right? And then the remnants of the hut in Norway, and then also the Mers Bow in Hanover. So this project has provoked, this is sort of the things that Adam was moving through.
Like, yeah, apart from his, I wouldn't say disdain, but criticism of what he was just describing there, which was the internal, quite alienating language of the art world, which I think some of his work tries to deal with really well, I think. But we're also talking about this idea of a project with an intention which somehow provided enough loose ends for when it ceased on the mark of the death of the author, it started to give birth to many social exchanges, specifically in relation to its reconstruction. Because if you think about the amount of artists die, okay, what are we going to do with the object, or what are we going to do with the painting, or how do we make the monument, how do we install the studio, Francis Bacon or something. With Merzbau, somehow there seems to be something slightly more unique in the amount of strands. And I think that's sort of, and strands which can be woven or weaved by a myriad of people. I mean, you and I included.
Well, I guess what this perpetuates is that notion of restlessness again, doesn't it? Or the impossibility of it ever sort of finally settling into a sort of a final, definitive resting place, because it can bring so many different people in to sort of work through it, or sort of, is this sort of what he was essentially, I mean, this is essentially it, isn't it? Because it can involve so many people's, you know, in its kind of thinking around it and ways of making it available, or, you know, or dealing with it in general, it becomes, yeah, like destabilized. I mean, it can never be officially in any one particular place, I suppose.
There's a massive desire to do so.
Yeah, there is a desire to do so. But that desire, that restless desire to do so, actually prevents it from stopping. So that restlessness for, you know, people's wish to kind of attempt to make it definitive actually keeps it moving in a way.
Yeah. No, we went on to talk about what the plans for the Merz Barn at the moment, and some of them are just, verging on ludicrous. A monument not so different to, you know, Lenin's body, or, you know, there's ideas of placing the body in the bottom, or there's photographs representing parts of objects that aren't there. There's so many voices in its potential reconstruction, and for me that's where it sort of comes alive, really. But it comes alive because it had a finished aim.
Okay, cool. Well, that's it. We've just run out of time. So I'm going to play like one more little track, which is a quote from the archive curator in Hanover that we spoke to. And we're going to be back here, I believe, on the 14th of May or thereabouts, with another programme and some more contributions, back with Jesse and also Will's recording. And and I'll just play this. And thank you very much for listening to the Movable Column. Here we go.
The most interesting aspect of this work is that it's a room in a flat, and it's absolutely the coming together of private things and private life, historical and sociological influences, found material, daily things. Bringing together these things and trying to find an abstract work that includes all of these in an abstract way is the meaning of his Merz concept. It's the most impressive thing to do. And he did also do this in his collages. But there was no assemblages, no collages, and no Merz pictures by Schwitters that show the coming together of all these many things with quite the same impact as this Merz bar. And this is why we're happy to have the reconstruction to explain this. But yes, it is very problematic.